All right, I'd like to start by laying a little groundwork, maybe a little background to this passage that we'll read today. The passage itself is a thank you note from Paul to the Philippian church for money they have sent to care for him or to provide for his needs while he is in prison. You bear in mind their imprisonment would be different from what we would know today, and the survival of a person would not be guaranteed. So they've sent to help care for him. I want, in our background, to lay to let us see maybe a little bit of the of how Paul deals with the touchiness of putting these three elements together in a message like this. And in the background, we want to have in mind the relationship that has been long-standing, the warm relationship that has gone on between Paul and the church at Philippi. And if you remember, to start with, there is the idea of their partnership, a close partnership that we have discovered as we've read this book. In chapter 1 and verse 5, notice that he mentions their partnership in the gospel. From the first day until now, he says, they have been with him in this work. They are partners with him in this grace, which has to do with the ministry, the service that they have the opportunity to participate in. Verse 7, and then in chapter 1, I think in verse 30 it is, they are partners with him in the same conflict. If you'll remember, the fact that people being going through hard times together seems to have a way of binding people closer together than just about anything else. And here they are partners in what they believe. They're partners in what God has given them to do. And they're partners in the hardship that they're having to endure in order to do that work. So there are three things that have a big impact on drawing these folks, Paul and the Philippians, close together. Now, Paul has admitted that. As he has written this letter about how dear to him they are. So there's not only the partnership that they're involved in, but there is the dear friendship, the brotherhood, if you will, that goes on, the affection that goes on between them. And you can read this between just a few of the lines. Look at look with me at chapter 1 and verse 7 mentions that he holds them in his heart. Verse 8 mentions the affection that he has for them. And then last time, chapter 4 and verses 2 and 3. Verse 1, chapter 4 and verse 1 mentions that they're his joy and his crown. There are other statements like that in this book. Enough to drive home the idea of the bond that exists between Paul and the church at Philippi. Now, what's unusual then against that background is when he gets to chapter 4 and verse 10, he starts a section that takes him through verse 20, in which he talks, in which he offers to them thanks for the money that they have sent to him. But he never uses the word thank you or the term thank you. He never mentions the word money. When you read what more scholarly people than I have written about this section, you'll notice that they will say Paul seems to be almost awkward, or Paul almost seems detached. He seems hesitant about really speaking of this out in the open, and that seems strange given how close he was to these people. Can you think of any reason why this might have been a touchy subject even with Paul in the Philippian church. Given what we have read as we've gone through this book, can you think of any reason why there would be some hesitancy about discussing something like this, knowing this red letter is going to be read publicly? All right. Maybe if I can prompt us along a little bit, at least in the direction that seems interesting to me. Remember that we have seen hints of the inward dissension that exists to some degree even in this great church at Philippi. Remember Euodia and Syntyche, for example. There is some kind of conflict that exists there. Remember that a big part of the burden of this letter has been to teach them how to use the mind of Christ to avoid selfish ambition and rivalry, or conceit and selfish ambition. Remember, that's been a big part of this letter. Remember in chapter 1 the hints that we have that Paul feels it necessary to say that he has this affection and love for all of them, not for some of them or one group or another, but for all of them. Now, knowing that, suppose you are able to help this fellow more than some other members might help. Suppose you already feel left out and you are one of the ones, remember in chapter 1, who was while Paul's in prison, you've been preaching the gospel for your own attention. Remember that? You're using his absence and his being in prison in order to get yourself some attention in preaching the gospel. All right, now, in that situation, what if a collection is taken and the money is sent off to him? Y'all are not very talkative in this new year. Is it just about preachers and money that you don't want to talk? I mean, you see, when I say it that way, you see, don't you, some of what I'm getting at with this fellow. Now, that's part of it. Yes, Eddie.
You talk about preachers and money. In one other place, Paul tells them that I did not take money from you. I worked with my own hands.
Yeah,
it's for. And here he's congratulating them, I see, for sending money for his needs.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 9 especially, he deals with that. And we'll look at that in a minute, part of that in a minute. But you see, part of it then is how do you say thank you for this gift without increasing the jealousy and the dissension that might already have some seeds sown in this good church. Now, on the other hand, remember some of the outward pressures that are being faced by these people. Remember, there are the people who are enemies of the cross of Christ at the end of chapter 3. What was the leading mark of the enemies of the cross of Christ? It was spending things on themselves. It was satisfying every desire. Their God was their own appetite, he says. They glory in shameful things and so on. So they have imaginations that are capable of assuming the worst. All right? Then remember that there are the ones that at the start of chapter 3 that Paul calls the dogs, who are teaching some different doctrines that he has had to think about this. He has had to address them by calling them the dogs. Now, if the ones who want to spend everything on themselves and the ones whose doctrines have been challenged hear of a collection being taken up and sent off to Paul, what are they going to use that as an opportunity to do toward the gospel? What are they going to say? You guys are not talking at all today, are you? They're going to say, well, there's nothing to what this man preaches. He's in it for the money. He'll say anything. You know, that would be the idea, Tom.
It seems to me that throughout Paul's writings, one of the things that he attempts to do is to say, this is not about me.
Yes, yes. And in this book, if you guys remember, we'll say this, and then we'll get into the text a little more. Remember how much trouble he's gone to say, the gospel is being preached whether I'm in prison or not. The cause of the Lord, the cause of Christ, is going to go forward whether I am executed or set free. Everything, the Lord, I'll be with the Lord either way. In this case, he seems to me to be saying, I will make it with your money or without, but I appreciate what you've sent anyhow. Okay, I think that sets this up in the right way. What Paul is trying to do is to deal with this and with this in a spiritual way. He's trying to say thank you in a spiritual way, and he's trying to recognize their sacrifice in a spiritual way. And that is the thing about this passage. It has something to teach to us about our relationships and about how to deal with money matters and about spiritual leadership, especially within the body of Christ. And there are a number of lessons here that I want for us to observe as we go along. It's a very vivid and meaningful passage. Let's start with chapter 4, verses 10 through 13. Brendan, you got your book open. Read for us if you don't mind.
But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last you have received your concern for me.
You have revived your concern for me.
Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me.
All right, thank you, Brandon. Now, just at first sight here, at first thought in reading that and knowing that there is a money gift in the background, what do you come away with it thinking? What is the opinion about Paul that you form in reading those few verses there?
It's not real high on his priority list.
All right. This was not the main thing on his mind. You get that idea. He has not, in his prison cell, he has not been pacing back and forth every 5 minutes asking the jailer if there's any mail for him. He hasn't. And think about this. He is trying to send a message to them about how they are going to respond in the conflict. Remember, they're engaged in this same conflict with him. So it's going to be important for them to see how he is coping with this hardship in his life. Chatty?
To me, it sounds like he's trying to tell them, too, that the only true unity, as many differences as they have, the only true unity is going to be in Christ.
All right, that's a big part of it. That will be the a central part of the message will be, where is the strength going to come from to deal with this? Do you find yourself, what do you find yourself thinking when he says, now at last you have revived your concern for me? I know you were concerned for me, but now you've had the opportunity. What do you think about that? What's he trying to say there? It's one of the things, by the way, that the commentaries run wild with.
Sounds like there had been support, then there wasn't, now there is.
Okay. It sounds, the easiest way to take it is be like it's kind of the springtime after the winter. You didn't have the opportunity to sin, now you did, and I appreciate it. I noticed his strong word. I rejoiced in the Lord greatly. You see that? Look back at the first part of this chapter. Remember chapter 4, verse 4. What had he told them? Rejoice in the Lord always. How are his instructions to rejoice in the Lord always? And again, I say rejoice. tied together with his rejoicing greatly in the Lord when he received the gift from them. How are those two things tied together?
I think it's more for their benefit of giving than his of receiving.
All right, he gets to that already. But isn't this a way of saying the Lord seems to provide? The idea is that here is one of the ways in which my instruction to rejoice in the Lord applies. Now, he hastens to say in verse 11 now, I'm not speaking of want or of being in need. In other words, his rejoicing was not because he had a terrible need that otherwise wouldn't have been met. His rejoicing, if you look at the end of verse 10, is that these people have been concerned for me. It's not the money, it's the fact that they thought of him. They put themselves in his shoes and they were concerned for him. And then in verse 11, look at what he says. I've learned in whatever situation I am to be content. Okay, now that's a hard lesson to learn, isn't it? To the idea of being content. What do you think about that word? I want to mention that we're dealing with what was a big matter among the Stoic philosophers of Paul's world. The Stoic philosophers taught that you should be unaffected by outward circumstances, and that all of your resources to meet life ought to come from within yourself. How is what Paul is saying here different from the Stoic philosophers of his day? I'll give you a hint. You're going to need to take verse 13 into account in answering that question. Is Paul saying, outward circumstances don't affect me because I have all the resources I need inside myself? Where are his resources coming from?
Christ.
All right, Christ. What he is saying is that he is prepared to face life with the contentment that the Stoics like to talk about. But because he had resources that were centered in Christ. And that is a beautiful picture if you think about it. I want to ask you to consider two other verses where this term for contentment shows up. First, 2 Corinthians 9, verse 8. Jan, get that if you would. And second, more familiar to us probably, 1 Timothy 6. And what is it, verse 6 or 8, 1, this idea will show up. And while we're looking at it, I want you to consider in your mind the efforts that people make today to gain contentment. The Stoics were at least discussing how human beings can achieve contentment. Paul is addressing it as well. What are some of the efforts that you know of that people make to try to possess more contentment? Buy more things? All right, what else? Pretty much they end up either doing more for the body or doing less for the body. That usually ends up either give yourself something or deprive yourself of something. Those are the approaches people take to contentment. And it can be with relation to money or popularity or some other thing like that. Look at these two statements, 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 8. Who has it?
And God is able to make all grace abound to you, that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed.
All right, and it's the word for sufficiency there. It's the same word for content or contentment in the other passages. So that you having all contentment and all things. So contentment, if I understand it right here, would be the idea that I will have the resources in the Lord to meet whatever life brings along for me. That generally would be the idea. Jan read, so that having all contentment in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work. And that coming from God's grace. Chatty?
To me, it's really important that he'll supply the need
Every
want.
All right. So if you think contentment is attached to every want, you probably never will have it, right? The need that we're talking about. Look at chapter 1 Timothy 6 and verse 6 next. What does it say?
But godliness with contentment is great gain.
All right, and skip down to verse 8 also, Eddie.
And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content.
All right, now, the idea in that pair of verses, it seems to me to be that contentment is attached to a godly way of life. Contentment cannot be found in anything that you're going to have to leave behind when you leave here, verse 7 says. Contentment would be the idea that you'd be able to find in God's provision and in His goodness the mindset which lets you know that you will be sufficient for whatever life demands, and that you will take what's important with you from this world. That would be a big part of the definition of contentment. All right, now back to Philippians 4, to what Paul says about this. He says, verse 11, whatever state or whatever situation I'm in, and then he describes two different sorts of situations in verse 12. What are they? Two different things that you may have to know how to cope with in life.
How to live with money and without it.
All right, I know how to be brought low and how to abound. This is the way the ESV translates it. Brought low and abound. All right, and you can see the two different ways of thought, the two different things are there. And then he may have to face hunger or plenty. He says a little later in verse 11 there. And then he mentions again need and abundance. And I'm going to use the word prosperity here to paraphrase it a little bit so you can see the contrast that's there. Now, which of those two sets of conditions or circumstances is harder to have contentment in? Years ago, I met a couple who had recently come back from doing years of mission work, and I believe in New Zealand is where they were, if I remember correctly. And they had had to skimp by on what money they could raise to do the mission work, and then they had had to live in a part of that country that at the time didn't have a lot of creature comforts. And they moved back to a town in West Texas near Lubbock, where I was in college at the time. And it was a town where they had a pretty good sized congregation. And that day, one of the things the churches did, provide a preacher's house. It was a big brick house, a four-bedroom house, and so on. And for some reason, I went there to speak in a VBS or something, but I had dinner with them. And somebody else in the dinner party said, man, you guys have a nice house. And the lady, the missionary's wife, said, well, we learned how to do without. Now we've got to try to figure out how to do with. Which is the hardest? With contentment. Michelle?
It kind of depends on where you start from.
It does. All right, it does. You can get off the track either way. What I'm trying to get at is we shouldn't think that If I only had those things, I would be content. What we should realize is that the same resources that can bring us through this are necessary to bring us through this. The problem is that we, in this situation, can forget our need for those other resources. And it so happens, who was the Frenchman that came to the U.S. in the 1800s, and Alexis de Tocqueville, pointed out how the American people seem to prosper and to be able to go wherever they wanted and to move wherever they wanted, all that kind of thing, but they were not content. And I thought about this a good bit, whether Clark Ridge, when Barney and I were boys, didn't have more of a sense of contentment than we do here now. I'm not sure about the answer to that. Tom?
For years and years and years, Marty and I complained of living on a policeman's salary. Now, we understand the great benefit of it.
Yeah, yeah.
We've realized that the great lesson, and quite honestly, we talked about it, and it was a great lesson that as we were younger raising a family that the Lord was teaching us and grateful. It may be one of the, I personally wonder if it's one of the great threats to our freedom in our country today.
Yeah, and to the happiness. You think, all you who've raised children, think about this. We've thought about, man, if we could just get our kids, give them what they need to get started out so they wouldn't have to go through what we went through that you're talking about there. They'd have everything easy and they wouldn't have to worry about the budget and all that sort of thing. But would we be doing them any favors if we could do that? Would they be able to appreciate then what was provided? I don't know, Russ.
It says here that he's learned the secret of being content. So it's something that's a little hidden.
All right, it's true. By the way, the word secret here was also the word that was used for initiation into the mystery cults of the New Testament world. So Paul has thrown in content and secret, which these pagan philosophies tried to convince people that they knew the answers to, and Paul is employing them to talk about Christ here.
Bill?
Okay.
Is that secret? Could it be the different places that Paul says, give thanks, be thankful, all things work together for the good of those, and all things give thanks?
I think those things are included. I believe the secret is stated in a summary form in verse 13. But it would take in what Tom just said, the giving thanks for always in all circumstances, and the knowing that God can work things together for good to them that love Him. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. Now, what does that mean to us? Why would you need to be strengthened?
Because you may face hard times.
All right, because you're going to face some things that call for strength. So Paul's contentment is not, if I will follow the Lord, He will make me healthy, wealthy, and prosperous. No, it's not that if I will follow the Lord, He will remove me from every temptation, from every trial, from every hardship. No, it is that He will strengthen. Remember Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, and Luke's account especially? The idea, when the Lord prayed, you remember like the sweat, like great drops of blood came from Him. An angel appeared doing what? Strengthening Him. And that's very much the idea here. The reason for the Christian's contentment is the idea that God will provide the resources that He will need to get through this, to face responsibility, to endure trial and so forth. And that's what Paul is saying here. I don't want you to think that since I'm over here in prison, my well-being depends totally on whether you guys are able to send money to me. That's what he's saying. The gospel is that God will strengthen his children for whatever they have to endure. Ruth, I think you were wanting to say something.
Well, some time ago, I read this prayer that somebody had wrote, and they said, I pray that the Lord will give me enough supplies that I will not be tempted to steal, but not so much that I forget where it came from.
Yes, very good. Proverbs 30 has very much that idea, I think verses 5 and 6. Who else? Michelle?
This has kind of come to me. If we learn appreciation instead of entitlement, we can probably deal with.
Exactly. That's a very good point. If we learn to appreciate goodness done to us instead of rights that we demand to be filled for us, we have a better chance at contentment, don't we? I get worried about a political system that's built on jealousy and envy. I think in the long term, we're not helping people much that way. All right. I want to not hold you to you 2 extra minutes after the second bell. Appreciate y'all being with us today. We'll finish the rest of this hopefully next Lord's Day.